Support for The Power of Words comes from the New York State Archives Partnership Trust, helping to preserve more than 380 years of New York's documentary heritage. www.nysarchives.org. New York State Council for the Humanities, online at nyhumanities.org. And EYP Architecture and Engineering, committed to preserving and restoring our nation's most prominent landmark facilities. www.eypae.com or 518-431-3300.
Words are powerful. They cause fear, confusion, and anger, or they can create shared understanding. But when words are delivered by a powerful political leader, their impact can inspire us to great action. And it is to those words that we turn now, in the power of words.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Welcome to The Power of Words, our year-long series that follows American history through some of the most memorable and inspiring political speeches of our time. Today we continue our series with a very special program that examines President Lyndon Johnson's voting rights speech, delivered to a joint session of Congress on March 15, 1965. I must say we are delighted to have two very distinguished guests joining us today, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin and her husband Richard Goodwin, former special assistant to President Johnson and author of the Voting Rights Speech, and a contemporary playwright, among many other accolades. Doris, Richard, thank you so much for joining us today. For those who may not know, Doris Kearns Goodwin is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. She received her Ph.D. from Harvard University, where she taught for a number of years. Her work as an assistant to Lyndon Johnson in his last year in the White House led to her first book, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, which became a bestseller. She followed up in 1987 with the political bestseller, The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, which was made into a six-hour ABC miniseries. Her next book, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The American Homefront During World War II, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in April 1995. Wait Till Next Year, a memoir, followed in 1997. Team of Rivals, I loved it. The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, published in October 2005, reached number one on the New York Times bestseller list, won the 2006 Lincoln Prize and the New York Historical Society Book Prize. Steven Spielberg is developing a feature film about the book with Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln. Ms. Goodwin is a frequent commentator on television and was the first journalist to enter the Red Sox locker room. Richard Goodwin graduated summa cum laude from Tufts, first in his class at Harvard Law, was president of the Harvard Law Review. He also clerked for Justice Frankfurter. Richard Goodwin was the special assistant counsel to the president in the Kennedy White House in charge of Latin American affairs and the Alliance for Progress. And Richard Goodwin was the special assistant to the president in the Lyndon Johnson White House, where he focused on domestic legislation and civil rights. He's authored a number of the most memorable speeches, including John Kennedy's Latin American speeches, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and civil rights speeches, the We Shall Overcome or Voting Rights speech we'll hear today, the Howard University speech, Robert Kennedy's South African speech, and Al Gore's concession speech in 2000. Richard Goodwin is also the author of five critically acclaimed books, including Triumph or Tragedy, Reflections on Vietnam, and Remembering America, A Voice from the 60s. Notably, he was the investigator of the rigged television quiz shows. His experience was made into an Academy Award-nominated movie, Quiz Show, directed by Robert Redford. Of course, Richard and Doris are husband and wife and are the proud parents of three sons, Richard, Michael, and Joseph. Again, welcome Doris and Richard Goodwin.
Very glad to be
Thank
with you.
You.
Well, it's wonderful to have you guys, and it's wonderful of you to do this with us. So I guess the first thing I want you to do is to talk about how you both got to know Lyndon Johnson. Richard, why don't you sort of set your relationship up with him, and give us a historical context of your work for the Kennedys and the holdover to the Johnson administration and how it happened.
Well, I worked for Kennedy, John Kennedy, as assistant special counsel to the president, and I was there in the White House when he was killed, and went through all those agonizing days together that we all did. And sometime after that, of course, I was now without a job, since the man I was working for had just been shot. And so I was talking to President Johnson, got involved in a contretemps over Panama and rebels that wanted to take away the Panama Canal, and looked like we were headed for a major international crisis. And I was in the White House, and Johnson beckoned me over to see him and said to me, "You know, what do you think about what's going on?" And I said, "I think it's terrible, Mr. President, because, you know, this is a little tiny country, Panama. They're used to being pushed around by people like us. You can't take that kind of approach to them and hope to have any persuasive force." He said, "Would you do it differently?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, write something out." So I went back to my office and I wrote a statement on the contretemps between the United States and Panama. And I heard nothing. And then 2 days later, Johnson walked into the press room and gave the speech as I had written it, and it had a great impact in sort of at least lowering the temperature of that particular confrontation.
Richard, you're one of the great speechwriters of the 20th century. There's no two ways about it. How did you get to be a speechwriter?
Well, I suppose you mostly get to be a speechwriter by associating yourself with someone who's giving speeches to the public, because I'd never been a speechwriter. I had written other things. And when Kennedy was still senator, he met me because I was one of his constituents from Massachusetts. And I said, "Well, when you're running for president," I said, "and I'd like to try to help," which I did want to. I knew him as my senator, and I'd met him personally, but not very well. And so I went to work, and I got another job on Capitol Hill, where I did the investigation of the rigged television quiz shows, TV quiz shows that were all rigged in order to let certain people win a lot of money and made national celebrities out of them. So I was in the midst of that investigation.
And you've been hired to do that by the Congressional Committee?
By the Congressional Committee, the House Subcommittee on Legislative Oversight under Orrin Harris. And, you know, they were just looking for another staff guy. And I didn't want to go back to practice law, which is the other choice I would have had. So I went to work for the committee. And the next thing I know, I was in the middle of this investigation that became a big, spectacular national investigation, and which I suppose nobody really remembers much anymore. But they did a good movie about it called Quiz Show, in which I'm a major character because of my investigating. And it was a good movie, would you think, Doris?
It was a great movie.
It's still around. You can still rent it, right? We don't get anything, though.
Netflix.
No. After that, I sent Kennedy a note and said I was finished working on the Supreme Court, where, of course, I couldn't participate in anything political.
You had been clerking for Justice
clerking
Frankfurt.
Clerking for Justice Frankfurt on the Supreme Court, right. But when that was over, I wrote him a little note and said, "You know, if anything I can do to help you, let me know." And I heard nothing, and then I went into the investigation of the quiz shows. Became a very spectacular thing nationally, although I don't think Kennedy knew anything about it himself or even know that I was involved. So he called me up one time and asked me to come over to his office, where I met Sorensen and Mike Feldman, the small little skeleton staff we had over there in the Senate. He was still a senator. So I met with him, and I met with Ted Sorensen, who was his chief speechwriter, and Larry O'Donnell, and people who have been with him for years, mostly. And I went back to work. And the next thing I know, a couple of months later, I got a call saying, "How would I like to try my hand at writing a speech?" Well, I'd never written a speech before in my life. I mean, except, you know, in college or something. So I said, "Okay." So I tried it, and I did that, and they asked me to do another one, and I tried that, and they asked me to do another one, and then he hired me. So I guess I sort of was winning a contest that I was unaware of the contest going on for several people to become the extra. He needed another speechwriter. His demands on the presidential candidate were mushrooming, far beyond they ever were in the Senate. And so I did it, and I did one, I did a couple, and the next thing I know, he hired me. And I was in the campaign at that point, and I spent the entire 60 days of that campaign bouncing around the country in the little single action conveyor that was what we had. Nixon had we were running against Nixon, of course, and he had a great big jet, and we didn't have a jet. But we had a nice little plane, and it was hard to write on it because it was continually bouncing around in the air currents. But anyways, for 60 days, that's what I did. We did a speech every night, and we did one for the morning papers and one for the afternoon papers. It was mostly Sorensen and me, and some other people participated from time to time. And then, of course, I went through the debates with Kennedy.
Let me stop you and ask you, Dick, was Sorensen easy to work with?
Oh, yeah, he was fine. We both had only one objective, which was to help Kennedy get elected.
And did the president put his hand to any of your speeches?
Oh, yeah, often. You have to give him enough time to look at them, of course. And since we were doing a speech a day and we were traveling around the country all the time, there often wasn't much time. But Kennedy always looked at the speeches, and he would make changes and suggestions. And
do you have any of those left? They would seem to me to be worth an awful lot of money with his corrections on them.
I don't know if I have any of them left. I have some of them. I remember one we were doing a speech on Castro, which, of course, Cuba had become communist. But we gave a speech attacking the Republicans for having screwed up the Cuban situation. And so all of a sudden, Kennedy stopped and looked over me and said, well, he said, the problem is we don't say how we would have saved Cuba. And then he shook his head and he said, well, what the hell? They never told us how they would have saved China. So that was the end of that discussion.
You mean the Republicans never told him how we saved China?
That's right.
Well, remember, though, when you were writing a speech for him about the farmers and agriculture?
Yeah. Well, I was remember the time I had to do a farm speech for him, and agricultural speech, which is not my strength, being from Brookline, Massachusetts, and Boston. We don't have very many farms out there. But I put together, from memos and what people had sent us, the outlines of a farm policy. And he looked at it, and he said, Dick, he says, here we are, a couple of Brookline farmers trying to save American agriculture.
Yeah. And then didn't he say, have you ever seen a cow?
He said to me, have you ever seen a cow? That was part of his sardonic humor.
Okay, so now you've worked for the senator. You helped get him elected. He now becomes the president, and you got to work for him there, too.
Right. I did. I mean, I hesitated a little because I didn't know when I want to get back into working with the same people I'd just been working with. But I did, and I came into the White House as assistant special counsel to the president and began to specialize in Latin American affairs. Now, that was interesting because I knew something about Latin America. A lot of my friends in Washington were people from various Latin countries who I discussed things with as we went along. So when we got into the White House, it wasn't that I knew a lot about Latin America, but nobody else knew anything about Latin America. So all the questions that came up automatically went to my desk.
Give it to Dick.
Right. Give it to Dick. Yeah, he's a Latin guy, you know.
Oh, tell him how you came up with your name, the Alliance for Progress, in the speech.
Oh, yeah, well, I was really riding in a bus through Texas, believe it or not, and a dusty bus, and we have this speech he's going to give, set forth his Latin American policy, which was a very hot issue then because of Cuba, Castro showing himself as a communist.
And wanting to take over all of Latin America, according to him.
Well, he obviously did want to take over Latin America, so do we. But, I mean, but we, you know, you have a limited power to do those kind of things. In any event, I was riding in this bus through southern Texas, and I said, you can't just call it Alliance. So I saw it on the seat next to me. There was a Mexican-American magazine called Alianza. And I said, that's it, Alianza. Now, of course, I didn't know any Spanish, but I could tell by my powers of deduction what Alianza meant. And but I had to check it out. I called some friends of mine in Washington who are people from Latin America. And I asked them, how does that sound to you, Alianza? And they said, well, that's not enough. It's got to be Alliance for something. I said, well, what do you suggest? He said, what about development? development. I said, how would you say that in Spanish? I said, Alianza para Desarrollo. I said, he'll never be able to pronounce that. Kennedy's was not very good with language. He made a great hero of himself with one German phrase, but that was later on. And so I said, you can't use Desarrollo. So I said, what about progress? So we said, okay, we'll call it the Alliance for Progress.
Amazing how history is made.
And that's right. And that became his official Latin American policy only a few months after the election, when he delivered a speech called the Alliance for Progress to a group of Latin American diplomats in the White House. So that's how the name came about.
Dick, so now you've worked as assistant counsel for Kennedy. You've done all of this work. What happens when Kennedy gets killed?
Well, I mean, nothing happened. He was killed. It was a terrible moment. It was a gut-wrenching moment for me when I found out I was in the White House when I got the news. And then I worked on helping set up the funeral arrangements. Jackie wanted the things arranged in a certain way. So did I. And we all had our ideas. You're looking back in the old books, back to the time of Lincoln's burial. You know, when somebody dies like that, you get caught up in all the details of the funeral and the obsequies. You know, you don't spend a lot of time.
Now, Jackie liked you a lot.
I hope so.
There are pictures all over here. There are pictures all over the house of being led into dinners at the White House with her on your arm. That must have been pretty heady stuff.
Well, I mean, the fact is that there aren't a lot of pictures. There are a couple of pictures around here. I couldn't have any more because my wife wouldn't have liked that. And so I
allow those two to be very forefront in the house.
She said, you can keep those two. And that's it. And I said, fine, that'll do for me. But, you know, we didn't think of it as being heady. We didn't even think of it that way. We were just doing our thing. We went out with attractive women. We had sex in White House corridors. The whole thing was booming. And meanwhile, we were working very hard on the various problems. I was working involved with civil rights and again with Latin America a lot. And, you know, that kept me busy most of the time, but not all the time.
How many hours a day were you in the White House?
Oh, I would say, let's see, average of 12 or 13 hours a day. But some days we were on the clock. You know, I would be writing speeches sometimes right through the night into the morning.
Oh, well, tell them about how you were able to sustain those long hours.
Well,
Besides
the sex and corridors.
Drugs. Drugs did it.
The doctor came in, right?
Well,
the shot.
They shot me with amphetamines.
Really?
That's how we kept going.
Was it JFK's doctor?
It was.
Yeah.
It was. Oh, I didn't know that at the time, particularly. He was later known as Dr. Feelgood. I had no idea how he was doing. I was in there writing a speech, sitting at the desk in front of a typewriter, but I was absolutely exhausted. I couldn't summon up the energy to finish this thing. I'd already been up for 24, 30 hours for writing. That's pretty concentrated time. So finally I called down to the White House doctor and said, look, I need three more hours. You got to find some way to get me three more hours.
And which speech was this, Dick?
I'm not sure which one it was. I don't think it was Vietnam.
No.
We were already drugged out by then. So any event, I'm there at the time of the typewriter, and in comes the White House doctor, a very nice young man, I think called Young, I believe. And he comes in, and he has a big hypodermic in his hand, and it was full of some red fluid. I never even looked over. I never asked what it was. I didn't care. I just held my arm out. He injected me, and by God, I got the energy to finish the speech. And what it was, I had no idea, then or now.
Amazing. Okay, so this
it's
is
not
a great...
amazing, that's the power of
no, it's amazing.
We all know about that.
It's amazing, and it tells us so much about what it was like in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So
we weren't always getting drugs, you know. We had other ways of dealing with our problems.
Yeah. Years later, Willie Nelson made history when he smoked marijuana in the Carter White House, but that's another old story. So, okay.
In the 60s, those were problems.
So, Dick Goodwin, one other question, because I think our audience would want to know. You dealt with Sorensen. You've dealt individually with the president all the time. Bobby?
Bobby. Well, I like Bobby a lot. And I didn't really work very closely with him. He knew me in the White House, and I would see him from time to time. We would talk. But I wasn't terribly involved with him till after his brother was shot. And then he would have me and a few other people over to his office in the Justice Department to talk about the future possibilities, if there were any.
You mean as in his political possibilities?
That's right, political possibilities and ours. We all felt abandoned in a way. Not we weren't purposely abandoned.
But. Now, it's well known that Johnson and Bobby Kennedy didn't like each other that much. Can you substantiate that?
Of course. They didn't like each other at all. I remember I went to, said to Bobby, and he was thinking about whether or not he might get to be the vice presidential candidate under Johnson's administration. And I said, Bobby, if he had to choose between you and Ho Chi Minh, he'd pick Ho Chi Minh. And the antagonism was much too great.
But you traveled to South America with him. I mean, you became really
with Bobby,
good friends
oh, yeah,
with Bobby.
It was all
Bobby
over
became
them.
One of his great friends.
Yeah. Bobby was a tough guy, though, wasn't he? I mean, he could be very tough with people.
Well, I know. I didn't see much of that.
You're
supposed to be tough.
Oh,
when
yes.
you're running the country, you're going to be pretty tough. I wish our present president would remember that.
So let me ask you this. Now the president is dead. You've helped Jackie into the transition. You've gone over to Bobby Kennedy's offices. You've talked about his political possibilities. You get into the White House with Lyndon Johnson somehow. How did that happen?
Well, of course, I was wandering around the White House at that time. That's why I had my office, where I knew all the people. And all of a sudden, there was a flare-up of dispute between the United States and Panama over the future of the Panama Canal. And we made these terrible statements about how we weren't going to let these little Panamanians push us around. The most snide, condescending type of remarks were coming out of our State Department and from other places, as far as I know. So I was in the White House at one point. Johnson knew I worked in Latin America, and he was getting criticized heavily for the way he was handling this. And he told me, what do you think I should do about this? And I said, well, Mr. President, you know, they're a little tiny country. They're very weak. We're the colossus of the North. You have to cater to their pride and self-respect. You can't just go around and say they do the wrong thing and they don't know what they're doing. I said, that will never work. You'd never use that in politics for yourself. And he just listened. He said, well, you write something. So I went back to my office and I wrote a little statement. And I had never heard anything. And then 2 or 3 days later, Johnson walks into his press room and gives a statement exactly as I had written it.
Wow.
And, of course, it transformed the whole situation.
Did he tell you he was going to do that, or did you just
know it? He took the statement. I had written it. He didn't have to get my permission to use it.
But so then he called you in soon thereafter, right?
Soon thereafter, he offered me a job in the White House, right? And I was in there as special assistant to the president.
Okay. So now let's bring us up to the speech we're going to hear today. How did it come to be that you wrote this magnificent speech, which is now known as one of the great speeches of all times, Lyndon Johnson on Civil Rights?
Well, by then, of course, I've been working for Johnson a little bit of some part of the time. I knew what was happening at Selma. I knew about the police riots, as the Colonel Commission later called them. And so it was natural for me to think I would do something on civil rights. But it was a Sunday, and nobody was in the White House except Johnson and Jack Valenti, who was always in the White House. Whenever Johnson was around, there was old Jack sniffing away.
Was Jack running the country?
No, he wasn't running the country. He was doing what Johnson wanted him to do. So in any event, I'm out at a dinner at Arthur Schlesinger's house, actually. And somebody comes in and says, you know, the president's going to give a speech to a joint session of Congress tomorrow. It was a Sunday. We were out having dinner. And so, of course, I assumed that I might be involved in it because I've been doing most of his major speeches at that point. So I went home and I had a White House telephone. We fortunate were constantly linked to Lyndon Johnson with an electronic umbilical cord, which is not the most comfortable position to be in, I'll tell you. And I went home to my house. So I had a White House phone. We all had that. Little White House phones with direct connections. And I called the White House operator and said, do you have any messages for me? She said, no, Mr. Goodwin. I said, somebody else must be writing that speech. And I turned over and I went to sleep. Next morning, I get bright and early, maybe as early as 9, I got to the White House. And there was Jack Valenti jumping up and down outside my office, waiting desperately for me. And I found out later from Bill Moyers what had happened. And President got up and Jack was there, as he always was, to wake up the president, make sure he had breakfast. And so he said to Jack, Jack had been the only one that had been at that meeting with the Congress people the night before, the only staff person. And he said, Jack, he said, how's Dick coming with that speech? Jack said, Dick, I didn't ask Dick to do the speech. I asked Horace Busby to do it. Horace Busby's a very nice fellow, but, you know, it's not his kind of thing. And so Johnson looks at Jack and says, you did what? He says, don't you know that a liberal Jew has his hands on the pulse beat of America? And you assigned it to a Texas public relations man? Well, that ended that. So suddenly I had to do the speech.
Moyers told you the story.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
That's great.
Anyway, it sounds good. I think it's pretty good.
So you did it.
So then I sat down to write the speech. And now it's 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, the fact is he's going to give the speech that night to a joint session of Congress.
Unbelievable.
So I sat down, I started writing it, and right through the entire day, obviously. And finally, I finished it at about 5:30 or 6, and then I had to go to the teleprompter, get on the teleprompter, and be there for the president.
So nobody else put their hand to this at all?
The president called up once in the middle of my doing it. He said, I want you to put something in about my teaching at Cotula, Mexico. He taught some poor Mexicans, so I put that in, obviously, and he used it in the speech. But there was no time for anyone to do anything.
Now, this speech takes the Southern sort of president who speaks with an inflection and everything else and puts his mark on why African Americans, or Negroes, as he called them in the speech, should not be penalized for just the color of their skin. And you make the most persuasive case that anybody could make, that anybody could project themselves into. Mm-hmm. Where did you come up with all that stuff?
I guess I just dreamed it up. No, it was this was one of the great issues of our time.
It wasn't.
The position of blacks in American society, it was a very live issue. You know, there have been some very vicious debates about it. And I had a very strong point of view, which I think Johnson shared.
You think he really felt it? It wasn't a political schema for him?
No. Yeah, I don't think at all. You know, if you're president of the United States, you never don't think about politics. But I think he finally felt in the end that his activity in the field of civil rights had lost the South to the Democratic Party forever. So if it was a political calculation, it wasn't a very astute one. But I think that's what did happen. The Democrats in the South deserted the Democratic Party because of what Lyndon was doing on civil rights. You know, his problems, of course, much rhymed with the Vietnam War, which was an entirely different set of issues. So I think he felt it, and I think he believed in it strongly. You know, he remember saying, you know, when I was a senator, he says, there wasn't much I could do. My whole constituency was white racist, virtually. He didn't use that phrase. But now he was president, and he could do it. He could take that risk. So he did.
Did Lady Bird play any part in all this?
I don't think so. I'm sure she agreed with him, basically. I don't think she had a bigoted bone in her body. But I mean, he did believe that everybody ought to have the right to vote, and he was a practical man, and he had to ensure it with practical measures, like sending registrars out of the South to register blacks.
Well, we're going to hear all the words you wrote as we listen to the speech. Nevertheless, there was so much empathy that came across in the speech. Do you have to learn to think as he does or to write as he speaks?
Well, yeah. I have to. In other words, the empathy for the plight of blacks in America was not hard to generate. You know, I mean, I was a northern white and he was a southern white. But the fact is that he knew all about what was happening in the South more than I did. And the terrible conditions, Jim Crow, we had a country of legalized apartheid. You know, blacks and whites couldn't use the same soda fountains or drinking fountains in the South. You know, people were being killed. You know, so I don't find it hard to summon up that empathy. And if I couldn't summon it up, I couldn't have written it either.
Well, it's
no way in which you could generate that kind of feeling in words if you don't have it in yourself.
Well, it's pretty clear that two presidents of the United States thought you were a genius and that you could do that for them. So I know that, you know, you're self-effacing, but I think it's clear that we have the real thing right here. Let's go to Doris Kearns Goodwin and ask the following question, and that is, first of all, how did you get to know Lyndon Johnson? We've had you on before, and you've described some terrifying moments when you were summoned up to the White House bedroom as a young woman, scared to death of, you know, this guy who is known as a bit of a womanizer. So how did you get to know him in the first place? How did he feel he should be calling you? You weren't the worldwide celebrity then that you are now.
No, surely not. I mean, what happened was that when I was a graduate student at Harvard, I was selected for a White House fellowship, a fabulous program. Colin Powell was a White House fellow, Wesley Clark. And we had a big dance at the White House the night we were selected. President Johnson did dance with me that night, not that peculiar. There were only three women out of the 16 White House fellows. But as he twirled me around the floor, he whispered he wanted me to be assigned directly to him in the White House. But it was not to be that simple.
Was he hitting on you?
Was he what?
Was he hitting on you when he did
that? Well, he was twirling me rather lowly toward the floor. So I had a feeling that, I mean, you could have gone to any department in the cabinet, but sure. He was saying, I want you with me. But unfortunately, what had happened was that I'd been involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, like so many young people at that time, and had written an article with a friend of mine, which came out in the New Republic several days after this dance in the White House, and the title was How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power. So no. I was certain that he would kick me out of the program. And for a while, there was discussions in the White House about what to do about this girl. But surprisingly, he said, I was only 23 at the time, 23, 24. He said, oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can. But I did not originally get assigned in the White House. I was considered too damaged goods for that. But Willard Wirtz was the only one who would take me in the Labor Department, and I loved him. Fabulous guy. And we would go to the White House every now and then as a group, and always Johnson would look at me and say, you ask me a question. So I would ask him a question, and it was kind of a funny relationship. And then what happened is, after Martin Luther King was killed, Johnson was going to give a major speech to the country, actually almost like the voting rights speech, to summon the country to do something on the economic condition of blacks, which is what Martin Luther King was arguing about. And Willard Wirtz was a very good speechwriter himself and
Secretary
was working on the speech. So he asked me to help him on that speech. And we stayed there for a couple of days. It was so exciting. But then what happened, the riots broke out in all the cities, and Johnson decided he could not give the speech because it would look like he was giving in to anti-law and anti-order. So we happened to be in a social function, the White House fellows at the White House, soon thereafter, and he came up to me and he said, how are you? And all I could think of saying to him was, I'm so sad you didn't give that speech. So he said to me, look, you've been criticizing me now for a year. First you said I should be removed. Now you're saying I didn't give that speech. You have to come and work for me. And I wasn't sure if he'd follow up on that, but he called Willard Wirtz and asked if he could have me transferred to the White House. So this would have been in April of 68. And bizarrely, I was so sad at leaving Willard Wirtz that I didn't want to go. And he said to me, you have to go. This will be an adventure of your life. So I ended up going to Johnson in April of 68. My White House fellowship was over in September, but then he asked me to stay until the end of his presidency, which I did. And then at the end, right at the very end, he asked me to come and help him on his memoirs full time in Texas. But I knew somehow that no matter how much I liked him and how much closeness we developed, to work for him full time in Texas would have been disastrous because you'd have no removal from that powerful person. So I kept telling him, no, I've got to go back to Harvard. I was going to be starting to teach at Harvard. So I'll never forget, he came up to me once. He says, what do you want to come and work for me anyway? What do you guys need? He said, you want a lot of money? I'll give you a lot of money. Do you want to travel? I'm going to be traveling around the world. You can come with me. You want a boyfriend? I'll import millionaires every weekend. You want to write? I've got a place on the lake, Lake LBJ. You can have a nice, quiet place with moon and stars. And so finally, I just realized, oh, my God, if I come, I'll be a little LBJ. So I just said, I loved all those things, but I needed to go back to Harvard. I said, isn't there any way I could work for you part-time? And he said, no, it's all or nothing. So I thought that was it. And then the very last day of his presidency, they'd already started dismantling the rest of the White House offices, and he called me into his office, and everything else was already undone for the next president coming in. And he just said, all right, part-time. So I ended up going back to Harvard, starting to teach, and I'd go down on weekends, summer vacations, and help him on his memoirs. And that lasted for the next couple of years. And that's when I really became close to him.
Did you have your PhD already?
Yes, I had my PhD. I'd gotten my PhD. Actually, while I was a White House fellow, I finished my thesis. Incomprehensibly now. It takes me so long to write everything. How I potentially wrote that thesis in the middle of being a White House fellow, I can't even imagine it now. because it takes me so long to write everything.
Well, because you, like your husband, are a genius.
Well, I don't know about that. But anyway, it did get done.
Okay, so you wrote a book about LBJ when you got out. Were you taking notes all along about that?
Well, what happened is when we were working on the memoir, he was constantly wanting us to take notes, the various people. And I worked on two chapters only, one on civil rights mm-hmm. and one on Congress. So they were the fun parts of his memoir because he was happy talking about those things as opposed to Vietnam. And so at times he'd be looking over and he'd say, "Now, don't you tell this to anybody in the whole world." Then you'd stop taking notes. And at other times when he was saying something I thought rather indelicate, I wasn't taking notes. And he'd look over and say, "Why aren't you taking notes? This could be important someday." So part of the conversations that I had with him did become that first book on LBJ and the American Dream.
So because we're listening to this famous speech on voting rights in which he does this incredibly courageous thing that nobody thought could ever happen in the United States. And only Lyndon Johnson probably could have gotten this thing through the United States Congress because he was, as we have all read, the master of the Senate. And when you were writing your two chapters, was he making reference back to these speeches?
Oh, yes. And he definitely knew that the voting rights speech was perhaps the best moment of his political life. I mean, he said to me that, you know, what happened, and Dick mentioned it earlier, that when he was the senator from Texas, he did not have the power to do what he might have wanted to do about civil rights. I think he always had it in him to want to do something. Even in 1957, he was the architect of a very mild, but nonetheless, the first civil rights bill that had gotten through the Senate under the Eisenhower administration. And then when he got to be president, he said, "I now have the power. I can do what I want." And then I think what happened is after Kennedy died and he decided in his very first statement that he would say nothing is more important to fulfilling Kennedy's legacy than the passage of the then Civil Rights Act of 64, which was the Desegregation Act, which I'm not sure that Kennedy could have gotten passed in the Congress. It took every bit of Lyndon Johnson's genius to get that filibuster broken, you know, be able to go to Everett Dirksen, the leader of the minority of the Republicans, and saying, "Dirksen, you come with me on this bill, and 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen." Plus, he gave him every dam, every public works project. But he brought the Republicans to join the Northern Democrats to break the filibuster, first time ever broken on civil rights. And so he passes the Civil Rights Act of 64. And I think what happened then is he said to me, it was just such an enormous feeling to know that you had done something that would stand the test of time. And it made him want to do even more. So then what happens is the Civil Rights Act is passed and it's time for his State of the Union message in 1965. And he decides to put in that message a call for voting rights. And a lot of people around him told him, "This is wrong. You've got to let the country absorb the Civil Rights Act. Everybody's got to take it slow now. The South cannot have another burden put on it." But he said, "No, I'm putting it in there." So he puts it in the State of the Union message, but then nothing much probably realistically could have happened with it because the country needed time to absorb that big Civil Rights Act of the year before until Martin Luther King took his marchers to Selma, to Montgomery, and it became an issue that required somebody to do something about. And then he had that instantaneous sense of timing to know, yes, this issue now has reached a boiling point. I'm going to take leadership of it, and decided to make that joint speech in front of the Congress, knowing that he could then push it to get the very thing he was hoping to do, which nobody thought he could do the year after the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. But he always said something like, "Voting rights is the meat in the coconut," or something. This is the really important thing, even more than the desegregation, or certainly equal to it. If you're going to give power to the African Americans, you need it through voting rights. I mean, the only thing if I can add, just because it's personal, so I was just a graduate student at the time when the voting rights speech was delivered, but I'd been involved in the civil rights movement, been down in the 1963 march, had been to the South marching. So this was an issue that mattered a lot to me as well, and gathered with a group of my friends, all of whom cared about this immensely. And we listened to Johnson give that speech. And I did not know Dick Goodwin then, but I thought it was the most extraordinary speech I'd ever heard in my life. And we were crying at that time. So I think there's no doubt that that memory of what that speech meant to me as the first extraordinary speech that I'd ever heard. I was just beginning college when JFK gave his inaugural speech, but that didn't hold a candle to what this speech meant. So the first time when Dick Goodwin came to Harvard to finish a book and I was introduced to him, I thought, wow, because then I knew this was the guy that wrote the speech. So that was probably a large part of the reason we're married and have children. I'm teasing, but it was certainly...
Maybe the marriage, the children were independent.
Yeah, the children did come separately from the speech.
You're listening to The Power of Words, a co-production of WAMC and the Archives Partnership Trust. I'm Alan Chartok, and we're here with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author Doris Kearns Goodwin and Richard Goodwin, former special assistant to Presidents Johnson and Kennedy, and amazingly, the author of the speech you're about to hear. Let's listen.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. I urge every member of both parties, Americans of all religions and of all colors, from every section of this country, to join me in that cause. At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. There, long-suffering men and women peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. Many were brutally assaulted. One good man, a man of God, was killed. There is no cause for pride in what has happened in Selma. There is no cause for self-satisfaction in the long denial of equal rights of millions of Americans. But there is cause for hope and for faith in our democracy in what is happening here tonight. For the cries of pain and the hymns and protests of oppressed people have summoned into convocation all the majesty of this great government. The government of the greatest nation on earth. Our mission is at once the oldest and the most basic of this country: to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man. In our time, we have come to live with the moments of great crisis. Our lives have been marked with debate about great issues. Issues of war and peace, issues of prosperity and depression. But rarely in any time does an issue lay bare the secret heart of America itself. Rarely are we met with a challenge, not to our growth or abundance, or our welfare or our security, but rather to the values and the purposes and the meaning of our beloved nation. The issue of equal rights for American Negroes is such an issue. And should we defeat every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars, and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation. For with a country as with a person, what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem. met here tonight as Americans, not as Democrats or Republicans. We are met here as Americans to solve that problem. This was the first nation in the history of the world to be founded with a purpose. The great phrases of that purpose still sound in every American heart, North and South. All men are created equal. Government by consent of the governed. Give me liberty or give me death. Well, those are not just clever words, or those are not just empty theories. In their name, Americans have fought and died for two centuries. And tonight, around the world, they stand there as guardians of our liberty, risking their lives. Those words are a promise to every citizen that he shall share in the dignity of man. This dignity cannot be found in a man's possessions. It cannot be found in his power or in his position. It really rests on his right to be treated as a man equal in opportunity to all others. It says that he shall share in freedom. He shall choose his leaders, educate his children, provide for his family according to his ability and his merits as a human being. To apply any other test, to deny a man his hopes because of his color or race or his religion or the place of his birth, is not only to do injustice, it is to deny America and to dishonor the dead who gave their lives for American freedom. Our fathers believed that if this noble view of the rights of man was to flourish, it must be rooted in democracy, the most basic right of all was the right to choose your own leaders. The history of this country, in large measure, is the history of expansion of that right to all of our people. Many of the issues of civil rights are very complex and most difficult. But about this, there can and should be no argument. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote. There is no reason which can excuse the denial of that right. There is no duty which weighs more heavily on us than the duty we have to ensure that right. Yet the harsh fact is that in many places in this country, men and women are kept from voting simply because they are Negroes. Every device of which human ingenuity is capable has been used to deny this right. The Negro citizen may go to register only to be told that the day is wrong, or the hour is late, or the official in charge is absent. And if he persists, and if he manages to present himself to the registrar, he may be disqualified because he did not spell out his middle name or because he abbreviated a word on the application. And if he manages to fill out an application, he is given a test. The registrar is the sole judge of whether he passes this test. He may be asked to recite the entire Constitution or explain the most complex provisions of state law. And even a college degree cannot be used to prove that he can read and write. For the fact is that the only way to pass these barriers is to show a white skin. Experience has clearly shown that the existing process of law cannot overcome systematic and ingenuous discrimination. No law that we now have on the books, and I have helped to put three of them there, can ensure the right to vote when local officials are determined to deny it. In such a case, our duty must be clear to all of us. The Constitution says that no person shall be kept from voting because of his race or his color. We have all sworn an oath before God to support and to defend that Constitution. We must now act in obedience to that oath. Wednesday, I will send to Congress a law designed to eliminate illegal barriers to the right to vote. The broad principles of that bill will be in the hands of the Democratic and Republican leaders tomorrow. After they have reviewed it, it will come here formally as a bill. I am grateful for this opportunity to come here tonight at the invitation of the leadership to reason with my friends, to give them my views, and to visit with my former colleagues. I have had prepared a more comprehensive analysis of the legislation, which I had intended to transmit to the clerk tomorrow, but which I will submit to the clerks tonight. But I want to really discuss with you now briefly the main proposals of this legislation. This bill will strike down restrictions to voting in all elections. Federal, state, and local. Which have been used to deny Negroes the right to vote. This bill will establish a simple, uniform standard which cannot be used, however ingenious the effort to flout our Constitution. It will provide for citizens to be registered by officials of the United States government. If the state officials refuse to register them, it will eliminate tedious, unnecessary lawsuits which delay the right to vote. Finally, this legislation will ensure that properly registered individuals are not prohibited from voting. I will welcome the suggestions from all the members of Congress. I have no doubt that I will get some on ways and means to strengthen this law and to make it effective. But experience has plainly shown that this is the only path to carry out the command of the Constitution. To those who seek to avoid action by their national government in their home communities, who want to and who seek to maintain purely local control over elections, the answer is simple. Open your polling places to all your people. Allow men and women to register and vote, whatever the color of their skin. Extend the rights of citizenship to every citizen of this land. There is no constitutional issue here. The command of the Constitution is plain. There is no moral issue. It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country. There is no issue of states' rights or national rights. There is only the struggle for human rights. I have not the slightest doubt what will be your answer. But the last time a president sent a civil rights bill to the Congress, it contained a provision to protect voting rights in federal elections. That civil rights bill was passed after 8 long months of debate. And when that bill came to my desk from the Congress for my signature, the heart of the voting provision had been eliminated. This time, on this issue, there must be no delay or no hesitation or no compromise with our purpose. We must not refuse to protect the right of every American to vote in every election that he may desire to participate in. And we ought not, and we cannot, and we must not wait another 8 months before we get a bill. We have already waited 100 years and more, and the time for waiting is gone. So I ask you to join me in working long hours and nights and weekends if necessary to pass this bill. And I don't make that request lightly. Far from the window where I sit with the problems of our country, I recognize that from outside this chamber is the outraged conscience of a nation, the grave concern of many nations, and the harsh judgment of history on our acts. But even if we pass this bill, the battle will not be over. What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome. As a man whose roots go deeply into southern soil, I know how agonizing racial feelings are. I know how difficult it is to reshape the attitudes and the structure of our society. But a century has passed, more than 100 years, since the Negro was freed, and he is not fully freed tonight. It was more than 100 years ago that Abraham Lincoln, a great president of another party, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But emancipation is a proclamation and not a fact. A century has passed, more than 100 years, since equality was promised. And yet the Negro is not equal. A century has passed since the day of promise, and the promise is unkept. The time of justice has now come. And I tell you that I believe sincerely that no force can hold it back. It is right in the eyes of man and God that it should come. And when it does, I think that day will brighten the lives of every American. For Negroes are not the only victims. How many white children have gone uneducated? How many white families have lived in stark poverty? How many white lives have been scarred by fear because we've wasted our energy and our substance to maintain the barriers of hatred and terror? And so I say to all of you here and to all in the nation tonight that those who appeal to you to hold on to the past do so at the cost of denying you your future. This great, rich, restless country can offer opportunity and education and hope to all black and white, all north and south, sharecropper and city dweller. These are the enemies: poverty, ignorance, disease. They are enemies, not our fellow man, not our neighbor. And these enemies too, poverty, disease, and ignorance, we shall overcome. Now let none of us in any section look with prideful righteousness on the troubles in another section or the problems of our neighbors. There's really no part of America where the promise of equality has been fully kept. In Buffalo as well as in Birmingham, in Philadelphia as well as Selma, Americans are struggling for the fruits of freedom. This is one nation. What happens in Selma or in Cincinnati is a matter of legitimate concern to every American. But let each of us look within our own hearts and our own communities, and let each of us put our shoulder to the wheel to root out injustice wherever it exists. As we meet here in this peaceful, historic chamber tonight, men from the South, some of whom were at Iwo Jima, men from the North who have carried Old Glory to far corners of the world and brought it back without a stain on it, men from the East and from the West are all fighting together without regard to religion or color or region in Vietnam. Men from every region fought for us across the world 20 years ago. And now in these common dangers and these common sacrifices, the South made its contribution of honor and gallantry no less than any other region of the great republic. And in some instances, a great many of them more. And I have not the slightest doubt that good men from everywhere in this country, from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico, from the Golden Gate to the harbors along the Atlantic, will rally now together in this cause to vindicate the freedom of all Americans. Us owe this duty, and I believe that all of us will respond to it. Your president makes that request of every American. The real hero of this struggle is the American Negro. His actions and protests, his courage to risk safety and even to risk his life, have awakened the conscience of this nation. His demonstrations have been designed to call attention to injustice, designed to provoke change, designed to stir reform. He has called upon us to make good the promise of America. And who among us can say that we would have made the same progress were it not for his persistent bravery and his faith in American democracy. For at the real heart of battle for equality is a deep-seated belief in the democratic process. Equality depends not on the force of arms or tear gas, but depends upon the force of moral right, not on recourse to violence, but on respect for law and order. And there have been many pressures upon your president, and there will be others as the days come and go. But I pledge you tonight that we intend to fight this battle where it should be fought, in the courts and in the Congress, and in the hearts of men. We must preserve the right of free speech and the right of free assembly. But the right of free speech does not carry with it, as has been said, the right to holler fire in a crowded theater. We must preserve the right to free assembly. But free assembly does not carry with it the right to block public thoroughfares to traffic. We do have a right to protest and a right to march under conditions that do not infringe the constitutional rights of our neighbors. And I intend to protect all those rights as long as I am permitted to serve in this office. We will guard against violence, knowing it strikes from our hands the very weapons which we seek: progress, obedience to law, and belief in American values. In Selma, as elsewhere, we seek and pray for peace. We seek order. We seek unity. But we will not accept the peace of stifled rights, or the order imposed by fear, or the unity that stifles protest, for peace cannot be purchased at the cost of liberty. In Selma tonight, as in every, and we had a good day there, as in every city, we are working for a just and peaceful settlement. And we must all remember that after this speech I'm making tonight, after the police and the FBI and the marshals have all gone, and after you have promptly passed this bill, the people of Selma and the other cities of the nation must still live and work together. And when the attention of the nation has gone elsewhere, they must try to heal the wounds and to build a new community. This cannot be easily done on a battleground of violence, as the history of the South itself shows. It is in recognition of this that men of both races have shown such an outstandingly impressive responsibility in recent days. Last Tuesday, again today. The bill that I am presenting to you will be known as a civil rights bill. But in a larger sense, most of the program I'm recommending is a civil rights program. Its object is to open the city of hope to all people of all races. Because all Americans just must have the right to vote. And we are going to give them that right. All Americans must have the privileges of citizenship, regardless of race. And they are going to have those privileges of citizenship, regardless of race. But I would like to caution you and remind you that to exercise these privileges takes much more than just legal right. It requires a trained mind and a healthy body. It requires a decent home and the chance to find a job and the opportunity to escape from the clutches of poverty. Of course, people cannot contribute to the nation if they are never taught to read or write. If their bodies are stunted from hunger, if their sickness goes untended, if their life is spent in hopeless poverty, just drawing a welfare check. So we want to open the gates to opportunity. But we're also going to give all our people, black and white, the help that they need to walk through those gates. My first job after college was as a teacher in Cotulla, Texas, in a small Mexican-American school. Few of them could speak English, and I couldn't speak much Spanish. My students were poor, and they often came to class without breakfast, hungry. And they knew, even in their youth, the pain of prejudice. They never seemed to know why people disliked them. But they knew it was so, because I saw it in their eyes. I often walked home late in the afternoon after the classes were finished, wishing there was more that I could do. But all I knew was to teach them the little that I knew, hoping that it might help them against the hardships that lay ahead. And somehow you never forget what poverty and hatred can do when you see its scars on the hopeful face of a young child. I never thought then, in 1928, that I would be standing here in 1965. It never even occurred to me in my fondest dreams that I might have the chance to help the sons and daughters of those students and to help people like them all over this country. But now I do have that chance. And I'll let you in on a secret. I mean to use it. That you will use it with me. This is the richest and the most powerful country which ever occupied this globe. The might of past empires is little compared to ours. But I do not want to be the president who built empires, or sought grandeur, or extended dominion. I want to be the president who educated young children to the wonders of their world. I want to be the president who helped to feed the hungry and to prepare them to be taxpayers instead of tax eaters. I want to be the president who helped the poor to find their own way and who protected the right of every citizen to vote in every election. I want to be the president who helped to end hatred among his fellow men and who promoted love among the people of all races and all regions and all parties. I want to be the president who helped to end war among the brothers of this earth. And so, at the request of your beloved speaker and the senator from Montana, the majority leader, and senator from Illinois, the minority leader, and Mr. McCulloch and other members of both parties, I came here tonight, not as President Roosevelt came down one time in person to veto a bonus bill, not as President Truman came down one time to urge the passage of a railroad bill, but I came down here to ask you to share this task with me and to share it with the people that we both work for. I want this to be the Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, which did all these things for all these people. Beyond this great chamber, out yonder in 50 states are the people that we serve. Who can tell what deep and unspoken hopes are in their hearts tonight as they sit there and listen? We all can guess from our own lives how difficult they often find their own pursuit of happiness. How many problems each little family has. They look most of all to themselves for their future. But I think that they also look to each of us. Above the pyramid on the Great Seal of the United States, it says in Latin, God has favored our undertaking. God will not favor everything that we do. It is rather our duty to divine His will. But I cannot help believing that He truly understands and that He really favors the undertaking that we begin here tonight.
That was President Lyndon Johnson's voting rights speech, delivered to a joint session of Congress on March 15, 1965. I'm Alan Chartok, and you're listening to The Power of Words, a year-long series of programs that follows American history through some of the most memorable and inspiring political speeches of our time. Joining us on the program today is former special assistant to President Lyndon Johnson and the man who wrote the speech you just heard, Richard Goodwin. Along with Richard Goodwin is acclaimed historian and author Doris Kearns Goodwin. They're married. Welcome back. Let me ask you both. I guess, Doris, you have this incredible historical appreciation of Lyndon Johnson. You knew the man well. You worked with him. Richard Goodwin, you wrote the speech. You had contact with him. When he heard that Jack Valenti had assigned the speech to somebody else, he blew his top and said, no, I wanted Goodwin to do it. And you wrote the speech in one incredible day. And in those days, it wasn't your computer to the teleprompter. It was you had to get it on teleprompter, as you have pointed out. So this is we have two of the best experts in the world on this subject. So I guess the first question I want to ask you is, I need to know what made Lyndon Johnson feel so passionately about this. I know you both have said it was not a political move, but the question is, what was it? Was it somebody who took care of him as a child? Was it some injustice he had seen? What was it that got into him to be this passionate about this?
Well, I think he said that when he was young, not only teaching the Mexican-American kids in Cotulla and seeing the prejudice that was being visited upon them, but also seeing what happened to blacks in Texas, not being able to eat in the same restaurants. He had a woman who had worked for him, and he saw how hurt she was when he'd travel with her and she couldn't go into the same places with him. So I think he didn't start with bigotry in him. For some reason, he was free of that as a young person. But then when he got into politics, he had to bend to some extent to the constituencies that he had to serve. But as soon as he had any freedom, even as Senator Majority Leader in 1957, he did what he could to get a civil rights bill through. But I think then what happens is once you get into that presidency, he was a man of enormous ambition, and he wanted to do something that would be remembered. And civil rights was the issue of the time, and he rose to that issue magnificently. I mean, he told me not long before he died that he hoped that if ever he were to be remembered for anything, it would be for what he did in civil rights. So it was part of his emotion. I think once you get accomplished and you do something, as I was saying, once you get that Civil Rights Act of 64 signed and you know how great it feels to be commended for that, to know that you've done something which no one had done for such a long period of time, you want to do even more. So you go for voting rights. And then even after voting rights, he goes for affirmative action. And he went even beyond that for fair housing. Things that by that time people are saying, now you're getting much too radical. He would have continued on. If it hadn't been for the war, he would have been one of the great presidents without a question. He wanted to out Roosevelt, and he was on his way to doing so had it not been for the war.
Well, now you say he wanted to out Roosevelt. I'm also wondering about the previous 1,000 days to his administration. Here was this bright, energetic, handsome, incredibly vigorous president. How much of, do you think was on his mind about out-Kennedying Kennedy?
Well, I think that, you know, when he was in the vice presidency, actually, he was involved in civil rights, too. I think he was the head of the EEOC commission. So this was always a subject that was important to him. And I think once he got into the presidency, what was so hard for him is that no matter how much he accomplished in those first months, everybody just kept saying, it's Kennedy, it's Kennedy, it's Kennedy. He tells a story one time about going to Appalachia, and he had done so much for the poor people down there, much more than Kennedy had done. But he went into a poor hut, and he saw a picture of Jesus Christ on one wall and JFK on the other wall. And he thought, oh, no, I'm not even here. So that anger at sort of not being appreciated as JFK was always with him. It wasn't that he didn't like JFK. He sort of got along with him. JFK appreciated his stories. He understood the largeness of LBJ. So all the anger that he felt toward JFK was always visited on Bobby Kennedy. But I'm sure it's true that he felt like JFK couldn't get this bill through the Congress, only I could. And it's true. I mean, JFK had mobilized the country. JFK was slow to come to civil rights. I remember when we were at the big march in 1963 hoping that JFK would show up, and he never showed up. And there was a sense of, what's he doing in the White House waiting? He was not our idol, those of us who loved civil rights. So I'm sure it gave Johnson a special feeling to know I've outdone JFK as well.
Dick Goodwin, how do you feel about that? You worked for both presidents. Was Johnson a competitor with JFK?
Well, I don't think he was a competitor with him because he was vice president and Kennedy was president. And the vice president didn't really get to compete with a commander-in-chief. But I think that there's no doubt in my mind that Johnson, once he got into office, he not only wanted to outdo Kennedy, he wanted to outdo everybody. You know, Roosevelt and Jefferson and all of them. And he felt this was the issue that which that could happen. So whether you call that ambition or not, I think a president wanting to be great and acting that way is a very useful thing for the country. I don't think we have much of that anymore. You know, I don't think Johnson at that point was even thinking much of JFK, except, of course, in his private moments, he probably said, I did more than that little yellow jaundice fellow. But, that's how he used to refer to him, right?
Well, when you started, Richard Goodwin, when you started with JFK in his Senate office and then as president and writing speeches for him, obviously you had tremendous respect for the guy. And when it came time to work for Johnson, you had some reservations, didn't you?
Well, fact is that I don't know if I had any reservations about that. I mean, Kennedy was dead. And there were people wandering around the White House that liked to pretend Kennedy was still in office. And he wasn't. And he didn't have the power. And I had loved Kennedy and grieved when he died and was friendly with his family. But on the other hand, now the business of the country was going to go on. The war was going on. The civil rights ferment was going on. And I felt that anything you could do to forward that would be great. I mean, remember once when I was first going to work for Johnson, I spoke to Bobby about it. Of course, he grumbled. He said, well, I suppose you can keep from blowing Costa Rica or something. He said, that would be good, which was his mild concession. Although there was no chance of blowing Costa Rica, actually, because they were pretty firmly in our camp and still are. And so, you know, maybe because I was younger, I hadn't been with Kennedy that long. But, I mean, once he was dead, the rest of your life couldn't be guided by your grief.
Did you come to love Johnson?
I came to like him a lot, yeah, and I admired what he was doing. I mean, there were times, like when this speech that we're talking about was delivered, I felt enormously proud of what he was doing. Because I had known from the discussion how hard this was to get out on the front of civil rights. He said, I've lost the country for the Democrats for a generation. And he knew that, and it didn't happen.
He knew it going in, yeah. That he would lose them. He'd lose the South.
Yeah, he did. You know, he had no great foresight of what would happen 5 years down the line. But the fact is, that is when the Democrats lost the South, and they never regained it.
Well, your brilliant wife wrote one of my favorite books of all times on Abraham Lincoln. And so what I'm thinking is, what did Lyndon Johnson think of Abraham Lincoln?
That's interesting. I'm not sure that he talked a lot about Abraham Lincoln.
No.
I think it was FDR that was his political father. And he had obviously been, you know, a young congressman during that period of time. He had worked in the National Youth Administration. And Johnson's every bone was in domestic politics. When you hear those tapes that he made, and you hear the depth of his concern about poverty and education and model cities, I mean, that's what's so tragic about the fact that he became involved in Vietnam, because he didn't care about foreign policy. He had no interest in it, which was part of the problem because he knew so little about it. So FDR's New Deal was what he felt in every fiber of his being and what he wanted to do in the 60s again.
And yet, Doris Kearns Goodwin, think about this for a second. The great change, of course, was the Emancipation Proclamation in Lincoln. And then comes Johnson finally doing something about it.
No, in fact, in that speech, don't you have something in the speech where you say Emancipation Proclamation was a proclamation, but...
It's not a fact.
It's not a fact. Yeah, I mean, you went back to that. That's exactly right.
Oh, yeah, well, Johnson did. You know, I mean, I have no idea what Johnson thought about Lincoln, but there's only one possibility, which is that he felt about him the way the local Methodist minister would feel if you asked, how is Jesus, what do you think of Jesus Christ?
Right.
You know, I mean, he was beyond critical evaluation. Whole American mythos.
Yeah, what saddens me is when Obama was inaugurated and everybody was talking about this extraordinary moment when the first African-American president was inaugurated, and people would mention JFK introducing the Civil Rights Bill, And they didn't talk about LBJ. And I was at an inaugural party, and Linda Byrd came up to me, and she really had tears in her eyes. And she said, it's just so unfair that they're not mentioning my father. And fortunately, I was standing next to Brian Williams and was going to be doing NBC with him the next day. And Brian Williams happens to really appreciate LBJ. So in the coverage the next day, we talked about LBJ. But he deserves so much credit for civil rights. There's just no question about it. He did more for civil rights than anybody since Abraham Lincoln. So in that sense, your question is absolutely right, because nobody had done very much at all, including FDR, on civil rights.
So let me ask you both this. If LBJ is looking down from the clouds right now, what would he be thinking about what America has done in civil rights since he got these monumental achievements passed?
Well, I think he probably would think that we could have done a lot better, a lot more. Right. He was never going to be in a position where he said, you made enough progress. It's not that kind of a question. He'd never come to an end of a possibility. And I think he would have seen that. And then he would have been very critical of some of his successes in the White House for not having handled it very well, because he was the master legislative tactician that ever occupied the presidency.
Right.
That's why he was able to get so much done. He made 2 years before Vietnam began to fall into him, he made more progress on all areas of domestic policy than any president had since Roosevelt, and maybe better than Roosevelt in some. But that's because he had good positions, but it was because he knew how to handle Congress, how to work with them, how to get support, and he would do that daily, every day. He got up in the morning, he'd begin to go to work on some congressman or other. I used to sit with him. He used to sit in the little sitting room opposite the White House, which has now become notorious since Monica Lewinsky. But at that point, he didn't have any of that notoriety suggested. That had to wait for Bill Clinton to arrive. You know, and he would sit there, and then he would get on the phone, and he'd have us come down, and he liked an admiring audience, and we hear him talking to these senators and congressmen, and, you know, he'd call on the phone, and it would be nighttime, and if the guy was the senator wasn't in, he'd ask for the senator's wife, and if she wasn't in, he'd ask for the kids, and he'd start talking to one of the kids, and said, you tell your daddy that your president, his president called, and I'd like to talk to him about something. And of course, the kid would say, fine, yes, sir. But he never let up. He never let up. And he looked for all the vulnerable spots. You know, he made deals, made plenty of deals, but he did them in behalf of what he regarded as higher goals, and which we all regarded as higher goals. I mean, it was more important to get Medicare through than to deny some bridge to somebody in Georgia. You know, give them the bridge and let's get Medicare.
I mean, think of it. I mean, Head Start, Medicare, model cities, federal aid to education, national public radio, national television. I mean, it's just an extraordinary array of successive things that he did. And you're right, he never stopped. I mean, they said he would call senators in the middle of the night. The one senator he called about 2 a.m, and he said, I hope I didn't wake you. And the senator said, no, I was just lying here looking at the ceiling, hoping my president would call. But I think that, you know, at least when he went to his grave, he knew that civil rights had been his legacy. The very last thing that happened at the LBJ Library was the opening of the civil rights papers. And he was very sick at that time. His heart was giving way. And there was such sadness for him in those last years. But that was a moment when I think, hopefully, he felt a sense. I mean, I do worry when you say if he was looking down, what would he say to me? And I keep imagining a panel of all the presidents I've ever studied. And each one is now sitting telling me everything I've got wrong in the afterlife. And LBJ's first words are, how come that damn book on the Kennedys was twice as long as the book you wrote about me? But I'd like to think that he would know. And I feel that the older I get, the more I'd like to spend some time thinking about being sure that people understand what this man did domestically, because it's been so scarred, and rightfully so, by the war in Vietnam. But it's important, I think, as time goes by, that we're able to realize that it wasn't natural what happened in the 60s on civil rights. It probably wouldn't have happened without him. I mean, maybe you needed the combination of JFK starting the process by going out for the civil rights bill, dying, and the martyred president. You wanted to get it done in his case. And then after that, it was all LBJ. Voting rights, model cities, housing, affirmative action. There's no way any other president could have gotten that through.
Dick Goodwin, you wrote the speech that we heard.
Yes.
The question I have for you is, had you to do it over again, Is there anything you would have put in or left out?
I doubt it. I mean, it turned out very well. You know, a speech, a political speech especially, or a governmental speech, it's not viewed as a composition. It's intended to create some action, have people respond in some way, to marshal the ranks of your supporters, whatever it is. I don't care how great the language is or the rhetoric. If you fail in that, then the speech is a failure. It's not an abstract exercise. It's done in a political context with the objective of moving people to do something or be against something, one or the other. You know, and I think that part of the purpose of that speech, which was to do something about the denial of voting rights to blacks in the South especially, it had a great impact.
4 months later, the Voting Rights Act passed, and there's no question that speech set the momentum.
One of the people beside Doris who cried when they heard the speech was Martin Luther King.
How do you know that?
Because the people who were with him at the time had written about it.
So, post-speech author Richard Goodwin, does the president ever put his arm around you and say, attaboy?
We're pretty close, yeah. I mean, yeah, they do. I mean, I must say, after Johnson gave that speech, and we went back to the White House, the little group that had been up at the hill with him, because he gave it at Congress, and he came, he sat there with me. I had him sit right near him, and the little couches around the thing. And then he finally leaned over. He went right to have a little bourbon after an occasion like that. And so did I. But he just leaned over the table, and he took the bottle of bourbon, and he poured one glass for him and one for me. And that's all I needed to hear.
After the speech, were you feeling accomplished in a particular way? Was it a high point for you in your life? What did having written that speech, because after all, the president gives it, the president gets the credit for it, what did it mean to you?
Well, I mean, I felt very strongly about the goal, which was to secure voting rights if you can for black Americans.
But do you ever feel a sense of incredible accomplishment?
Later, maybe. How much later?
When
the dust settles and history has dealt with it all, and you can focus it. But, you know, what happens after a speech like that, if you've given it, there's something else the next day. The work of running the country never stops. It's not as simple as just being off by yourself trying to wonder what you've done. You know, that may come after a while, but not then.
What did you think about Johnson in front of Moyers having said, I want a guy who's a liberal Jew who can put himself into this? What did you think of that?
I thought it was a good point.
Why?
Because I'm a liberal Jew, and I really have felt it very strongly. And that there were other people who were not so Jewish and not so liberal, probably, who felt strongly. But I thought it was great. Johnson got right to the heart of things.
What do you think about that, Doris?
Well, I think that Johnson knew, obviously, that Dick was the person to write that speech. So I can imagine that he was stunned when he came in that morning. It still amazes me that he could write that speech in that day. I couldn't do that if my life depended on it. Not even possibly. I need to spend hours and hours working on something, and I can't even work under an easy deadline of a year, much less a day. And I look at that speech, and when you ask how does he feel about it now, it just gives me shivers to think that he wrote that speech. I think it's the most incredible speech. And when I think about it, it's not just the words, history and fate meet at a certain place at a certain time. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was at Appomattox. So it was at Selma, Alabama. When he finally comes into the part about this isn't a Negro problem, it's not a white problem, it's an American problem, you just feel yourself swelling with emotion. And then all of us in the civil rights movement, the We Shall Overcome was our anthem against the government, in a sense. We were wondering, why are they not listening to us all the way through? And then when the President of the United States takes up the anthem, We Shall Overcome, and he pauses right before he says it, and we shall overcome. I remember, again, listening to that speech and feeling, oh, my God, he's one of us, which you don't always feel about a president, especially in that kind of key moment. So to be able to take the outside pressure, I mean, what makes things happen in America so often is public pressure coming from the outside, pushing people on the inside. And so here's an insider, the President of the United States, using the words that are glorious, but allowing himself to connect to that movement that is pushing him rather than feeling pressured by it. Because presidents don't like to be pressured from people on the outside. And yet he was absorbing it. He was giving it its own value at that moment. So that moment was unbelievable.
Lincoln was supposed to have written the Gettysburg Address, at least apocryphally, you know, on the back of an envelope in not that long a time. It's one of the great addresses of all times. Dick Goodwin writes it in a day.
Well, and so Lincoln's was only 2 minutes long. But again, but in fact, Lincoln had actually a habit whenever he was thinking about a future speech of writing down pieces of it on small pieces of paper. And so most of the historians now think that he had started compiling those before the speech. But again, now the interesting thing is when Lincoln gave that speech, he didn't think it scoured well, as he said, because it ended so abruptly that the audience didn't even know he was done, so they didn't applaud. But then he knew, I think, as time went by, that this might last. And it did.
Did you ever think, Dick Goodwin, that you went too long with the speech? Because it was a long speech.
Well, I don't know. The audience trick is, how did your audience react? If they're being held by it, being emotionally involved, then it's not too long. And if they don't, you could have given too much of a speech in 3 minutes. It has a question of whether you have done something. It's like writing a play or a poem. You know, do you hold the audience? And because I said, the speech doesn't exist in the abstract. It's a political occasion, and it's aimed at a particular audience. Now, maybe a nationwide audience, or maybe 100 people in some graveyard in Gettysburg.
What's that thing you always say about Patrick Henry?
I used to say, if Patrick Henry got up and said, give me liberty or give me death, to a meeting of the Rotary Clubs in Virginia, no one would remember him today. So the context of it is critical.
The interesting thing is, I wonder if you had had time to edit it, maybe you would have made it shorter, but as it turned out, probably, you know, that's the kind of thing you can do when you edit without time.
And when you have computers, no computers.
Yeah,
then.
Exactly.
You know, you can actually edit pretty well on a page, type page, but, you know, you're not talking about something of a 1,000-page document.
When you were sitting there and you were listening to the president give the speech and the people were applauding for incredible amounts of time, mm-hmm. Is that when you knew you had done good?
Well, I don't know if I knew that. I mean, I could tell from the audience reaction that. But I got that from just listening to it, listening to my own words and thinking, that's great. It's working and it will work.
Right.
And it did work. You know, and the only judgment is whether something works. It's not like writing, you know, the great soliloquy in Hamlet. Maybe that doesn't work, but it, you know, it does okay in that play, in that context. But, you know, this is very different. I mean, no president of the United States would feel the least bit satisfied if he was told he had just given a great speech and finds out that absolutely no one else liked it.
We hear President Obama now talking to the nation, and he doesn't have a particular connection, emotional connection, as he's speaking in a way that mm-hmm. people are going to applaud him for over a minute as he takes a break. What could Obama learn from Johnson?
Well, I think, you know, what's striking is that during the campaign, when Obama had a live audience, he was good. He needed that break from the teleprompter to smile, to relax, to say something spontaneous. When he's talking on a teleprompter in front of the Oval Office without a live audience there, he hasn't learned how to do that. You know, that head going back and forth, there's not an ease with him. I mean, Reagan could do that as an actor. He could make it feel, he could just summon the audience who wasn't there in his mind visually. So I think they've got to figure out a different way for Obama to speak to the American people. I've often thought the best thing he does is when he's in conversations with people, when he had the summit originally with the Republicans before the health care bill, and he was relaxed and spontaneous and quick-witted. And I've often thought he should just go out and have a meet the press thing every other week, and he's the moderator, and the anchors are all there, because that would show off his intelligence. But somehow the speaking in front of the teleprompter, I mean, Johnson somehow was much better when he had a live audience, too. I mean, when he spoke in front of the teleprompter, they used to say he was afraid to go anywhere without it because he called the teleprompter mother, because he had to be with mother at any point in time. It's hard for somebody to do that, and very few presidents are able to do that. And I think that's what Johnson was able to do much better when he had a live audience.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Remember, you can listen to any of the programs you hear at WAMC.org. I want to thank our wonderful, wonderful giving guests today, Richard and Doris Kearns Goodwin. Thanks also to our producer, David Gustina, and to our wonderful engineer, Adam Claremont, the LBJ Presidential Library and Museum, for providing the speech, and a special thanks to Bob Bullock from the New York State Archives Partnership Trust. Be sure to join us next time for another discussion about a great political speech on the power of words.
Support for The Power of Words comes from the New York State Archives Partnership Trust, helping to preserve more than 380 years of New York's documentary heritage. www.nysarchives.org. New York State Council for the Humanities, online at nyhumanities.org. And EYP Architecture and Engineering, committed to preserving and restoring our nation's most prominent landmark facilities. www.eypae.com or 518-431-3300.